I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Florida Panhandle is picking up after Hurricane Ivan today, but a tempest of another sort has been swirling in a Tallahassee courtroom. The question before the state Supreme Court, should Ralph Nader be on Florida's presidential ballot this year? Lest there be any doubt about the stakes, consider the lawyers. Arguing for the no side is Lawrence Tribe. He represented Al Gore in Florida in 2000. And for the yes, Kenneth Sukaya, who worked for George W. Bush in 2000. And today's case follows yet another courtroom drama in which Florida's Secretary of State was ordered not to put Nader's name on the absentee ballot, but did so anyway. Joining us to talk about all of this is S.V. Date, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Palm Beach Post. S.V., tell us briefly first, what were the arguments by both sides this morning?
Well, in the Supreme Court this morning, the Democrats argued that you know what? The whole Reform Party nowadays is kind of a sham, and the only reason they even had this convention after already deciding on Nader was to comply with Florida law that said that you had to have one in order to avoid gathering, you know, 5,000 signatures.
What does the other side say?
The other side said, well, you know, nowhere in the statutes does it say you can't have a convention after the fact, and nowhere does it say that what a national party is or a national convention is, and now they're trying to create definitions when the legislature never intended any, and so, you know, as a matter of law, they have to let them on.
So the question is about whether or not Nader's party, the Reform Party, is a legitimate party. When is a decision expected?
Probably late today or early tomorrow at the very, very latest. The court has said several times that it's cognizant of the September 18th deadline for mailing overseas absentee ballots.
Well, let's talk about those for a minute. The question as to whether or not Ralph Nader's name would appear on these absentee ballots in Florida, this involves a legal skirmish between the Florida Secretary of State, Glenda Hood, and a circuit court judge named Kevin Davey. He issued a temporary injunction last week that would have kept Nader off the ballot while the questions that we just talked about are resolved. What happened?
Well, it was interesting because Judge Davey had scheduled a trip out of state for a while and so hurried up and had this long hearing, 7-hour hearing last week to decide that, okay, Nader's name can't appear on the ballot, and said that if you've got a problem, if you want to appeal, you want to do it tomorrow and then I can have a hearing to talk about the stay.
And he cited the Democratic argument that the Reform Party isn't a national party under state law.
That's right. Well, the Secretary of State's office the next morning sent out a notice to the 67 counties saying, okay, Nader's name can't be on the ballot. Here's the ballot as it appears now. They waited till over the weekend until after Kevin Davey was in California, out of state, unable to hold a hearing to undo whatever the secretary might do. She then appealed and then within an hour sent out a notice to the 67 counties saying, Nader's back on the ballot. Make sure to include his name in what goes out. And then a few hours after that, lawyers for the Reform Party, for Nader, went to federal court and took it out of the jurisdiction of the state courts entirely. The whole thing seemed to the Democrats as if it was planned in advance.
Well, how did Judge Davey respond?
Judge Davey was not happy. He was not a happy camper coming back from California, and he basically all but that the Secretary of State's office is working kind of on behalf of the Reform Party in this case, that they were not an honest broker, that they really did have an interest in this. And that, of course, goes to Governor Jeb Bush. Because after all, unlike 2000, when we had an independently elected Secretary of State, now the Secretary of State is an appointee of the governor.
And in fact, some people say that this is not on the part of the Reform Party as much as on the part of the Republican Party, because it's expected to siphon, a Nader vote is expected to siphon votes from John Kerry. Well, did the absentee ballots with Nader's name on them go out?
Well, that's a little unclear because there is no central clearinghouse for that information. There are 67 counties. You know, in the end, what's interesting is we're talking about a total of 25,000 overseas absentee ballots, many of which are going to folks in the military, which I'm going to guess those folks are not predisposed to vote for Ralph Nader in the first place. So this is a big, big fight with big names over a very small number of potential ballots that might be taken away from Kerry. It shows you just how adamant each side is not to lose a single vote this time around.
Well, and let's remind ourselves, Al Gore was ahead in Florida until the overseas ballots were counted.
Right. Al Gore would have won had the absentee ballots not been counted from overseas. But more important than that, he would have won had Ralph Nader not been on the ballot at all. Ralph Nader got 97,000 votes that year. And it's pretty clear most of those would have gone for Al Gore had Nader not been on the ballot.
S.V. Date is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Palm Beach Post. S.V., thank you.
Thank you so much.
In the race for the White House, President Bush is campaigning in North Carolina, while Massachusetts Senator John Kerry is on the stump today in New Mexico and Colorado, and neither candidate is saying much on the campaign trail. About the brouhaha over possibly fake documents used to question the president's Vietnam-era service in the National Guard. But a lot is being said about it on conservative talk radio and on the Internet. We'll get to that in a moment. But joining us first is Nolan Finley. He's editorial page editor of the Detroit News. And Nolan, the two boxers went into the ring this week. Both spoke before the National Guard Association. Who, if anyone, landed the bigger punch?
It's hard to say, but clearly this campaign is boiling down to who can sell the American people that they'll be the best commander-in-chief. If you look at the new Gallup poll, that's a battle that Kerry appears to be losing at this point.
Yeah, that is a huge 13-point difference, I believe.
It's getting wider instead of narrower, which is not what we expected coming out of the convention.
We should say, of course, other polls are showing about a 6-point difference.
Right.
But
they're all over the map.
Right. To the guards again, Kerry did get some ovations. They mostly had to do with his comments on soldiers' benefits.
Right.
And President Bush got many more, but some say that John Kerry was pretty brave to go in and say that the commander-in-chief had not told these guardsmen the truth about Iraq, Kerry citing yesterday's dismal intelligence report.
Well, this is a strategy he has to pursue. He has to attack Bush's judgment on the war and Bush's prosecution of the war. He probably will gain no points if the debate becomes, should we have got rid of Saddam or not got rid of Saddam? Where Bush is vulnerable and where he can attack him is on the prosecution of the war. Did we plan it well enough? Have we executed it well enough? Or has Bush leveled with the American people?
Mm. Well, the other big story of the week is this still raging controversy over the documents that CBS television used to call into question President Bush's service record in the Texas Air National Guard in Vietnam. Now, CBS is standing by the content of the documents, and they are now saying they'll do a complete investigation. But it's raising a lot of questions about just who's driving the news. Now, Nolan, this week we spoke with Kelly McBride. She's of the journalism watchdog group, the Poynter Institute, highly respected. She said one of the questions raised was why the White House had the documents. In other words, she felt that they also had them in addition to CBS. But we heard immediately from our listeners.
They were not in the Pentagon record, and that the ultimate source of these documents was CBS. And the White House just handed to reporters what CBS had given them. Kelly McBride would have known this if she had paid any attention to the weblogs that the mainstream media spends so much time dismissing.
Well, in fact, we called Kelly McBride back, and she agreed. She said that they're going to have to set up watchdogs that just watch the blogs. And I'm wondering, Nolan, how does your paper treat the blogs?
Well, we're like everybody else. We're trying to get a feel for how important they're going to be. But we certainly watch them. We certainly read them. And they certainly are changing what the definition of journalism is. I mean, and for people who sign onto the Internet and type in a word or a phrase and 1,000 or 2,000 items pop up, it's very hard to tell which are the credible sources, which aren't the credible sources. But I'll tell you, at this point, they're extremely fascinating. And it seems like everybody is a journalist all of a sudden.
And we also don't know which political parties are now going to be behind some of those blogs.
I would be surprised if they don't enlist bloggers and start blogging themselves, right, if they haven't already.
I didn't know you could use that as a verb. But Nolan, Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News, which now reads the blogs. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we turn now to Tom Taylor, who is editor of the industry newsletter Inside Radio. And Tom, the blogs, as we said, first put the story of the potential forgery of the CBS documents out there. But a conservative radio then took that up. How much influence do they have?
Things happen so fast. There's such a compressed time frame in what happens, Robin. And blogs are kind of the leading edge. Talk radio picks that up. And by the way, I would cite what now looks like an early founding father of all this, Matt Drudge. Matt proved that you could put content, breaking news content, I mean, Walter Winchell kind of stuff, on the Internet on a second-by-second basis and drive people to that. And I think Drudge looks like a real forefather of this.
Except that Drudge was often wrong.
leading news reports often are.
Yeah.
But they get corrected, and we always say the daily journalism is the first draft of history, right?
Yeah. Well, let's listen to some of the conservative talk on the air this week, people who say they are shaping the dialogue. We start with a local Boston host. His name is Jay Severin, and he is speaking to start about U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan.
Memo to Kofi from Jay. Shut your face. No one sensible, no one patriotic, no good American, no one who isn't a suicidal, pacifistic, panty-wearing lemming gives a crap about what you have to say about anything.
And you thought it couldn't get any better. Rush on the EIB network.
I'm sure some Democrats don't want Kerry to win, but the power structure of your party is oriented toward Hillary in 08. Make no mistake about it. And they're willing to go through a Bush second term and try to impeach him in the second term. You'll have plenty of stuff to be excited about because they're going to try to impeach him. No, no, really. Not. They're going to try to impeach him over Abu Ghraib. I make that prediction. But look, Joe, can you hang on through a break?
But I just told you what I would do if I were president of CBS. Dan wouldn't say anything because he's my quarterback. I'm protecting the quarterback from getting sacked by, you know, everybody who hates him, which obviously he's got a lot of enemies. So do I. I know how that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, with apologies to some of our listeners, we heard from Jay Severin, Rush Limbaugh, and Bill O'Reilly, and we're talking to Tom Taylor, editor of the industry newsletter Inside Radio. Tom, a lot of people say that a lot of these radio stations, we were talking about who's behind the blogs, a lot of these radio programs are just arms of the Bush administration or arms of the Republican Party.
I think the Democrats in the 1990s didn't realize the impact of Rush Limbaugh and the incredible growth of talk radio in the early 90s. I call it the Rush Limbaugh template because before Rush came along in 1988, there wasn't much in terms of a political syndication. He grows, you know, enormously, and then suddenly by 5 years later, there are almost 600 stations that carry Rush, which is more stations than used to do the news talk format in 1988. Rush propelled that, and other people looked at that and said, ah, Rush's attitude and his entertaining persona is the way to do that.
Well, but do you see party members, left or right? I mean, obviously we see the left behind the new Air America network, which isn't, you know, doing all that well, although...
Actually, it's doing
fine. It's doing a little better, yeah.
But the Democrats and the progressives were very far behind and are still catching up.
Do you see the right targeting, let's say, stations in the swing states? Do you see it happen? Can you track that?
There's a clear affinity between the RNC and the Bush White House and some elements in the talk community, and that's natural. That's totally understandable. And the Republicans have gotten very good at working that system. Conservative talk works best because it has a few easy-to-understand mantras, lower taxes, you know, smaller government, maybe school vouchers. Right now it maybe carries a flip-flopper. Democrats, really since the John Kennedy era, have lost the vocabulary of how to talk about their issues.
Mm. Tom Taylor is editor of the industry newsletter Inside Radio. Tom, thanks so much.
Pleasure, Robin.
And in just a moment, we're going to see what some may say is that affinity. We're going to speak with the host of a conservative talk radio program, Scott Hannon. His influence is far greater than his reach. He's based in Fargo, North Dakota. So why do his guests include Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Laura Bush? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Scott Hannon has a talk show on WDAY in relatively tiny Fargo, North Dakota, and he considers himself part of the so-called new media. Well, I spoke with Scott yesterday about his show, his mission, and about all those people lining up to talk with him. Hey, Scott.
How are you, Robin?
I'm just fine, and I remember seeing you at the Republican National Convention and watching this crowd of Republican bigwigs coming to your doorstep, and you know that others have asked you this as well. How is it that a talk show that airs on a pair of 5,000-watt AM radio stations in Fargo, North Dakota, is getting such access to so many people, other than the fact that you're so good?
Well, thank you for that, and I do remember Andy Card leaving us to go talk with you, Rob.
Okay, so. Well, there's that.
Yes, the president's chief of staff, but you know what? Twofold. One, obviously, it's a heated presidential election, and we're fortunate to have listeners in a contested battleground state of Minnesota. A reporter called me recently from the Boston Globe and said, really, Scott, I mean, the only reason they're talking to you is because you're Minnesota. I wouldn't say that. because quite honestly, we've done interviews with Vice President Cheney and others way back in the early term of this presidency, and obviously they didn't know at that time Minnesota would be a battleground state in 04. So.
Well, you know, I looked, and I can't believe your guess. Karl Rove, chief advisor, Laura Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and you know, some people are saying it's location, 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 but also that you have a conservative bent and you roll out the red carpet.
Well, I mean, first of all, anytime a guest comes on a program, be it conservative, liberal, independent, whatever, if they enjoy their experience, there's a better chance they're going to come back than not. And I have a firm belief that the mainstream media, prime example that we're watching unfold over the last week, CBS and Dan Rather and the meltdown, is talk radio exists. It's a new media to counterbalance. To serve as equal time to the establishment media that, in my view, is very biased.
Well, you know, let's talk about that, because we've heard others also call themselves the new media. What do you mean by that?
The Internet, talk radio, the blogosphere now is growing. I would put all of them in the category of new media, whereas establishment media, mainstream media would be the broadcast networks, would be the major newspapers in America. The vast majority of our listeners say, you know what, I don't trust what I get from CBS News. So I want to go to other places and find out more, and that's what they get when they come to us.
Well,
and
Scott,
I think the guests, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to get asked the same questions by Dan Rather over and over and over again. Watch a White House press briefing. It's the same questions over and over and over. And you know what? If you watch it on C-SPAN, it's boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's
Scott,
annoying. And what we do is something different, and I think the reason some of these guests come back is because they appreciate the fact that it's a different approach.
Well, Scott, what do you say to those who say it's new media in that it is an arm of the government, that it is actually flacking the government's agenda most of the time instead of being critical of it, which is what the Fourth Estate is supposed to do?
Well,
a checks and balance.
Number one, some people say to me, for instance, Scott, you're obviously a supporter of this president. Is there anything you don't like about him? And I'll say, you know what, there are some criticisms that I have, and I do voice those from time to time. But you know what, there's a whole other establishment out there that lives to do that. You know, Dan Rather has been mad at the Bush family since George Bush 41 said to him, you know, Dan, how would you like it if I judged your whole career on those 7 minutes you walked off the set because you were mad that the U.S. Open took precedence over CBS News? You know, he's mad at him. So he's got an agenda. We're an antidote to that. We're equal time to that. People know what they're going to get there. So, you know, CBS can serve that role just fine. You know, the Washington Post and the New York Times can continue to be relentless attack dogs in the administration. We're going to go in there and look at it from a different approach. And you know what? That's what our audience wants because they're leery. They're distrustful of mainstream media sources.
Well, now look, CBS is saying that they are going to be investigating. They still stand by the content of the documents, but they are investigating their validity. You know, there's a feeling that when what's something that's perceived as misinformation comes from talk radio, if you will, or the new media, if you will. Let's take the Swift Boat veterans, for example, which every major news organization vetted and discounted much of the Swift Boat material. There's a feeling that there is no self-examination by, as you call it, the new media.
Look, if we were simply shills for the people that we may politically support, do you think we'd be around? What we are is an anecdote to the media that, quite honestly, has become too firmly entrenched in an ideology that is very different than more and more and more of the mainstream of America. My job as a talk show host is simply to, number one, give my opinions. And quite honestly, that's a transparency that's also different than much of the mainstream media, because you're told that you're getting a story from a reporter that has no dog in this fight. Not true. Only need to look at the New York Times recent survey about how reporters plan to vote in the upcoming election. They were 30-1 in Kerry's favor.
You don't believe that reporters would not allow their opinion to get in the way of their what they see their job as, which is to look at both sides of an issue
not.
And try to come up with an answer.
I think that's not human. I can't firmly stand for something and then say, I'm going to set what I firmly believe in aside, and I'm going to objectively report on this. There are some that can, but it is very, very difficult, and the vast majority do not. I couldn't do it. It's tough to do.
Do you
because
see?
If I have an opinion, I have an ideology, I have an agenda, which I believe the majority of the media is anti-war, so they come at everything about Iraq as we shouldn't be there. What are we doing there? He wasn't doing anything to us, and therefore everything is through that prism.
Do you also see your job as advancing the administration's goals?
No. Because, again, then I would be a stooge, and my audience would see right through that. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
But it is to say, here's some people that I believe are doing the right thing to take on the enemy, terrorists. And you know what? They're having to fight the mainstream media every step of the way. So guess what? I believe they're right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use a venue that we have in talk radio in breaking through that, in getting to the story, and getting to the truth, and getting to the facts. Now, am I saying, gosh, I think they're a bunch of idiots, but it really because my audience likes this, I'm just going to say this. Of course not. This is conviction. This is passion. This is a firmly held set of beliefs, and I share my opinions. Mm-hmm. That's what talk radio, and I take opinions that, you know, from listeners and callers that agree with me, that disagree with me. That's great. That's the picket fence of the 90s.
Scott Hannon, 8:45 to noon, every day on WDAY AM 970 in Fargo. Thanks so much for talking to us.
I enjoyed it, Robin. Call anytime.
Okay, next week on Here and Now, Beyond Swift Votes and Media Wars, we're going to look at how both candidates, Bush and Kerry, plan to reform health care. And the National Archives opens a public screening room. What will history buffs be able to hear there? That's next week. Stay with us. More ahead here, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Exactly 1,821 people were arrested during the Republican National Convention in New York in August, and one of them, 21-year-old Mark Perro, has filed a civil suit against the city, saying he wasn't even protesting and shouldn't have been arrested. That suit is expected to open a floodgate of litigation by others, including those who say they were protesting, exercising their rights of free speech, and they also shouldn't have been arrested. The litigation comes in addition to an upcoming hearing on whether the city should be held in contempt for disobeying a Manhattan judge's orders to release more than 500 people arrested during the RNC. Alexandra Marks is covering the suits for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now on the line from New York. Alexandra, tell us first, this fellow who's filed the suit, was he caught in one of those rollout fences?
He was caught in one of those nets. It's estimated of the almost 2,000 people who were arrested, it's estimated almost 300 were innocent bystanders.
You remind people that, you know, there's a New York is a maze. You couldn't even tell if there was a protest on the next block until you rounded the corner, and the police had these big orange rollout fences. They would just roll out and sometimes arrest everybody who was in them.
There was one woman I talked to yesterday who was coming out of a bookstore, and she was just stunned, and she kept saying to the police, well, wait a minute. You know, I'm on my way home. And she said she had her briefcase, and she was dressed as she was coming from the office. But police kept saying, no problem, no problem. And she ended up in lockup for, I think, 48 hours.
Right. Now, is the city ready for what is anticipated to be a flood of litigation?
I think the city is. One of the main issues is that by law in New York, protesters have to be released or anybody has to be before a judge within 24 hours. And many of these protesters were kept 36, 48, 50. There's a concern that these were purposeful detentions to keep protesters off the streets, which would be a real violation of the First Amendment. The city insists, no, that's patently false. We were just not prepared to deal with, you know, 1,000 protesters being arrested in a 5 or 6 hour period. That was on August 31st.
And meantime, during this time, a judge ordered at least 500 people to be released. What's the state of the contempt order?
There'll be a hearing on that on September 27th. The city would like to have it released.
Alexander Marks, thank you.
My pleasure.
Alexandra Marks reports for the Christian Science Monitor. Well, the arrests outside Madison Square Garden were one indication of the strength of security at the RNC. Inside, Secret Service operatives, hundreds of them, paroled the hallways and floor of the hall. And while the Secret Service has long been visible at presidential appearances, their presence and role at recent events seems to indicate a growing role. At a Pennsylvania event earlier this month, agents supervised the arrest of a group of AIDS activists who had been heckling the president and were removed from the room. The agents then told reporters that they would not be allowed back into the event if they interviewed the protesters. A spokesperson for the Secret Service said that dealing with hecklers is the job of the candidate or police, that Secret Service agents don't normally get involved. But some say that's changing. Philip Melanson is head of the Policy Studies Program at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth and the author of The Secret Service, The Hidden History of an Enigmatic Agency. And he joins us now. Professor, can you start by reminding us, what is the official role of the Secret Service?
Well, officially, besides investigating counterfeit and money crimes, they are responsible for protecting the president, the vice president, and virtually anybody else that the president puts on a list of protectees. And, of course, in post-9/11, that list has expanded dramatically. Mm-hmm. But they certainly are not supposed to, by their own rules and their own code of culture, participate as political advance people or in any way manipulate the political process on behalf of a president or a candidate.
And as we saw in that Pennsylvania event, that seems to be what happened. They were the ones who arrested the hecklers. Isn't it normally members of, as you said, the president's advance team or political operatives?
Usually, but I'd like to draw a distinction here. There has been a pattern in the past in which both Democratic and Republican presidents have attempted to use the Secret Service for political purposes. For example, in the Nixon administration, the Secret Service would throw out just enough hecklers so the president could speak, but keep just enough hecklers to make it look dramatic. What I think is different here is the dimension of telling the press that they cannot come back into an event if they talk to the protesters.
And an agent reportedly told one journalist who was blocked from, you know, going back into the speech that that was punishment for even attempting to speak to the detained demonstrators, and that they were going to have a different set of rules for reporters who didn't seek out the activists. They would be allowed to go back into the speech.
There have been charges in the past that the Secret Service's dealings with the press, because they do have control about who gets into a room and who doesn't, have been politically motivated at the behest of presidents and administrations. But this seems to me less subtle than the instances that I'm aware of from the historical record in the past.
Yeah. Give us some other subtle reminders that this might be different from the past in the Bush campaign. Do you see those?
Part of the problem we have here is that unless there's a witnessed event such as we're now talking about, behind the scenes there can be a lot of politicking going on by the Secret Service that we wouldn't necessarily know about. Another thing that's changed here that we have to keep in mind is that while the Patriot Act does not address the press and how they can be excluded from an event, one of the puzzles that we haven't yet figured out is that the Patriot Act now allows people to be removed and detained if they are in any way perceived as impeding law enforcement, which of course can be interpreted to mean anybody carrying a placard. So on the front end of that, of removing the demonstrators, I have to point out that according to the Patriot Act, they may well have had a mandate to do that, but excluding the press is not addressed by any law, and it's something exceedingly political.
There's another instance that we'd like you to comment on. Reportedly, again, one agent cooperated with a plan by the Bush campaign last month when former Senator Max Cleland, who is a Kerry supporter, he was attempting to hand a letter to the agent outside the Crawford Ranch, and apparently the agent cooperated in some way, again, which some might call politically, in impeding that.
Anytime the Secret Service removes somebody, it could be one of two things. It could be completely politically motivated, or it can be that they believe somebody's a threat. Now, I find it fairly difficult to believe that if the Secret Service was doing their job, they should know who Max Cleland is and that he was delivering a letter. So I would put this in the realm of the political rather than the protective.
To some of the other points that you've made, this is a different time. This is post-9/11. There are serious threats. How much is that perhaps a part of a shift in the role of the Secret Service?
Oh, I think it's a big part. First of all, they're more overworked than they were before. They couldn't possibly produce enough agents to protect everybody that needed protecting after 9/11. So I think that their job is more stressful and that they're strung out more as an agency. Having said that, I think also this is an administration that, frankly, does not hesitate to mix the political with the national security, and the Secret Service is the perfect entity for that because they can't blow a whistle. They can't talk about their work, what they do, what they don't do. They can't complain of being used or abused by presidents or administrations because it's against their code. And if you tell them to do something cooperatively, politically, that they don't do, presidents and their staffs can hold it against the Secret Service and keep them at a distance. So it's a strange relationship that goes on under a blanket of secrecy.
Philip Melanson is author of the book The Secret Service, The Hidden History of an Enigmatic Agency. He's also head of the Policy Studies Program at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. Professor Melanson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, we'll conclude our look at a program that tries to convince kids to refrain from sex until marriage. So how many of those kids who take that pledge actually follow through? You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. This week, we interviewed both a representative of the American Federation of Teachers and a Harvard researcher about charter schools, public schools which are run privately and receive public funding on a per-pupil basis, but in varying amounts from state to state. Lisa Geisman of Brookline, Massachusetts, writes, "Parents today need a doctorate in statistics to sort the wheat from the chaff in all this data." And we also received a letter from a listener who wanted to remain nameless but ran a charter school in Phoenix. She writes, "The gentleman from the teachers' union claimed that charter schools get just as much money per student as traditional schools. That is flat out wrong. We receive about 60%. As a result, we had to rely heavily on outside sources such as grants and parent support to meet our financial obligations. And after 3 years of fighting with people, I quit. And I would suggest to your guest from Harvard that charter schools are not necessarily better than public schools." Well, we talked last week with Senate Intelligence Committee co-chair Bob Graham about his outrage over how and why we went to war in Iraq. Jeff Abbott from Gloucester, Massachusetts, had two questions.
I was left wishing the interviewer had asked the senator a follow-up question, which was whether he shared his explosive information from General Franks and his interview with the Saudi with his Senate colleagues at the time. Not to mention the American public. And why is this information only coming out now? Thank you.
If we have another opportunity, we will ask him. And we heard from listener Kristen Wickstead, who was concerned about the use of the word inclusion in our report on new technology for special needs kids. We said inclusion meant rearranging a class around a disabled child. Kristen, a speech-language pathologist, writes, "The classroom, from my experience, doesn't get rearranged at all. The typical students in the class usually get an in-service type of lesson on the child's disability and have the opportunity to learn and ask questions. Inclusion in this way can work well with right supports and the right staff and students, and there is little, if any, rearranging." And finally, some listeners might remember this sound. We heard it during our visit to a town on Long Island on the anniversary of 9/11. Manhasset lost 40 residents on September 11th, and that fire alarm struck a chord with listener Chris Wood of Scituate, Massachusetts. He writes, "Your story brought back memories of the firehouse sirens, which, in addition to announcing fires, sound across Long Island at 12 noon every day. As a kid, it was a good feeling to hear the sirens and know it was time to head home for lunch. Well, I was back on Long Island visiting my brother on 9/11 and all morning trying to reach him on the phone. As a doctor working with the homeless in Lower Manhattan, he immediately rushed to the site upon seeing the second plane crash into the World Trade Center. After a very tense day with his wife and daughter, we were overjoyed when he came home that night covered in white dust up to his chest. The next day, when I heard the siren, I felt the same feeling I did as a child. All's well. David was safely home with us." As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
It's a sterling silver ring.
They've got writing on them. It says
1:3:4,
and it's
1 Thessalonians something.
The Bible verse, 1 Thessalonians
chapter 4, lines 3 and 4.
God wants you to be holy, so you should keep clear of all sexual sin. Then each of you will control your body and live in holiness and honor.
This week, Sean Cole of WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit has been examining the abstinence-only program, The Silver Ring Thing. A couple of years ago, the Pittsburgh-based ministry first performed its three-hour high-tech variety show in New England at a high school in Easton, Massachusetts, and they didn't know how they'd be received. The show urges its mostly teenage audiences to don the aforementioned silver ring and take a public vow to refrain from sex until marriage. Well, more than 600 kids put on that ring that night, about two-thirds of the crowd, so many that the show ultimately decided to set up a hub office here in New England. In the final part of our series on The Silver Ring Thing, Sean Cole talks with some of the kids who've pledged and looks at whether that pledge works.
Silver Ring Thingers tend to describe the show the same way.
The skits that they use are Saturday Night Live skits
based around sex and not having it until you're married, basically.
It's kind of a mix of Saturday Night Live meets MTV meets Jesus Christ. It's really awesome.
Okay, so this is the weird thing. Last year, on the same night Silver Ring Thing was here in Boston doing its abstinence-themed versions of Saturday Night Live sketches, the same night, April 12, 2003, Saturday Night Live aired this sketch.
Welcome to another episode of What's the Rush? I'm Becca, and beside me is my boyfriend of 3 years, Sean. This is a show for and by people who've made the pledge to forego sexual intercourse until marriage.
Just because you abstain from sex doesn't mean you have to abstain from life.
That's so true. Last weekend...
The sketch depicts pledgers as little sexual tension landmines. They fidget constantly, can't catch their breath. Sean, the boy, keeps scraping the heel of his hand down his pant leg.
Do you maybe not want to do some jumping jacks?
Yeah, okay, jumping jacks, okay.
I am gonna kill you!
Okay.
If Saturday Night Live's take on abstinence pledgers isn't very flattering, it isn't surprising either. I think it's safe to say that a lot of people view abstaining from sex before marriage as alien and extreme, which is partly why the pledge works, at least according to this guy.
The pledge creates a kind of minority identity community.
This is Peter Behrman, the director of the Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy at Columbia University. He's been researching the abstinence pledge movement for about 10 years.
As long as the proportion of adolescents in the community is small enough to feel distinct, then they can hold on to this identity. It's constitutive of the sense of self that they have, and then translates into behavior.
In 1994, Behrman and a bunch of other sociologists began the largest survey of adolescents ever conducted, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, or ADHealth. They surveyed tens of thousands of kids, and one of the questions they asked was,
"Have you ever taken a virginity pledge?"
To their surprise, 12% of the respondents said yes. Behrman estimated that 2.4 million adolescents nationwide had vowed to forego sex before marriage. Even more surprising, he says, the pledge actually worked to some extent. Kids between 14 and 17 tended to put off sexual activity for an average of 18 months. This was a full year before Silver Ring Thing was even created. Nonetheless, talking to Silver Ring Thing pledgers is a little like physically strolling through the pages of Behrman's research. For example,
kids who pledge are more religious.
I have another ring on my middle finger that's a cross. That's like my holy hand, I guess.
Kids who pledge are more likely to be involved in extracurricular activities.
I have track practice later on today and kickboxing.
They're more likely to come from intact two-parent families.
I don't even know if my dad knows. I mean, I'm sure my mom tells him because my mom tells him everything.
Their romantic relationships are more visible to family and friends.
You know, my parents are always home. His parents are always home. And we hang out in big groups sometimes.
They're across the board more normative than non-pledger kids.
And that thing Behrman was saying before about the pledge creating a minority identity community? A 16-year-old pledger named Kendra Rennick pretty much told me the same thing, though not in so many words.
I kind of feel like a loner, but I feel kind of
special that, you know, people, like, kind of either will look up to me or kind of look at me kind of weird, but at the same time, I know that I'm different than other people, and I don't really have a problem with that.
At first, it was really tough. I mean, I'm not going to lie.
Tiffany Kelly is 17.
I wasn't expecting people to, you know, roll their eyes or laugh at me because I was wearing the ring, and that really hurt because, you know, I was thinking, well, this is really powerful and it really means something to me, but over time, I just kind of took it with a grain of salt, and now I realize I wouldn't want it any other way. I mean, I want it to be hard because I want it to be worth it. You know, I want it to be worth something to my husband. When I go to the altar, I want to say, I waited for you and I put up with all this. That's how much I love you.
Doing something out of love for a person you haven't met yet is a leap of faith. And for the most part, pledgers are familiar with that kind of leap, being as religious as they are. They're not just hoping to meet their future spouses. They're praying to meet them. And in some cases, they end up praying for a long time.
So you took the pledge when you were 14.
Mm-hmm.
And how old are you now?
I'm 24.
This is Carolyn. She didn't want me to use her last name. She's on the board of Silver Ring Thing New England, but she actually took the pledge with another group called True Love Waits before there was a Silver Ring Thing. Carolyn says she's grown up watching friends' relationships come and go, watch them deal with heartbreak and STDs. It kills her, she says. But it also reminds her why she waited, which is not to say she doesn't wonder when she's going to meet her husband. In fact, she wonders about it.
Daily, several times a day. I keep waiting. It's like, okay, Lord, when is this going to happen? I've waited 10 years now. But I know that when it's meant to be, it'll be.
Do you ever dream about who that person is, what they're like?
Sure, all the time. And I have certain things, you know, I'm looking for.
Such as?
Well, I would hope that he would be sexually pure also, but, you know, that's not a definite.
This is something I heard from almost all the pledgers I talked to. At the same time that they staunchly advocate abstinence, they say it wouldn't be realistic to limit the pool of potential mates to people who've never had sex before. And they're right, especially considering AdHealth's most recent finding when it went back and re-interviewed pledgers from the original survey 10 years ago. Peter Behrman says of those who were sexually active, only 12% also happened to be married.
Now you might say, oh, that's a surprise. But it didn't actually surprise us. It seemed almost what you would expect. People's lives progress through stages, and intimacy and intimate relationships are part of growing up.
Behrman is quick to point out that taking the pledge probably helps a lot of kids put off sex until they're ready, even if ready doesn't necessarily mean married. But the rate at which kids break the pledge isn't the only news AdHealth uncovered.
I encourage you to come up front to see the slides because I'm going to blast through them at breathtaking speed.
Earlier this year, Behrman released AdHealth's latest findings at the National STD Prevention Conference in Philadelphia. He told his colleagues that while some prevention strategies work in the short term, that doesn't mean they work in the long term.
For those who do not like detective stories, pledgers have STD rates as young adults as high as non-pledgers. More interesting, where the proportion of pledgers in a community is high, the STD rates in that community among both pledgers and non-pledgers is high.
Behrman gave this talk on March 9th. On March 10th, it was reported worldwide. Strangely, more than one news source ran the story under the headline,
"Virgin teens have high STD rates." You know, you stare at that for a while, you go, oh, no. You know, like, how did they pick that?
The point is that pledgers shouldn't have the same STD rates as non-pledgers. They have sex later than non-pledgers, they get married earlier, they have fewer partners, and their partners aren't any riskier than non-pledgers' partners are. So what's the missing link?
It's called a condom.
Behrman says about 40% of boys who pledged said they used a condom in the past year, compared to 60% of boys who didn't pledge. The Silver Ring Thing rejects out of hand the idea that condoms are going to help solve the STD problem. Besides, the group says, kids are going to learn about condoms in public school no matter what we say. But whether or not pledgers know about condoms doesn't mean they're going to use one or even have one handy in the heat of passion. In any event, the kids I talked to honestly didn't seem like they would be caught dead having sex before their honeymoons. And whether that means Silver Ring Thing is inherently more successful than other pledge programs, we won't know until the program finishes its own study on itself 2 years from now.
reporter Sean Cole. Our series on the Silver Ring Thing was produced by WBUR's Inside Out Documentary Unit. For more information and for pictures from the Silver Ring Thing show, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.